Here we are. We start chapter 19 in the synthesis of yoga, the section which Sri Aurobindo named eventually the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. This chapter is the planes of our existence. It was first published on the 15th of June, 1917, in the philosophic journal Arya. And Sri Aurobindo did not return to revise it. We read it as it stood then. There's much to say about this beguiling title, The Planes of Our Existence. So maybe before we begin, we can share a thought or two about this. The term plane is a word which we use in English, derived from the Latin planum, which means a flat surface. So, it's something upon which something rests. The term that you'll find more often in Veda and Upanishad is padam, for step, for foot. So, these various planes of a common existence are different steps coming from or leading to. If you think of Sri Aurobindo's great epic poem, Savitri, obviously, Book 2, Canto 1, The World Stair, where every plane of existence is seen by Ashwapati as he begins his ascent. And then the rest of Book 2 traces out that journey into the inner nature and upward towards the Supreme, towards the source from which it all comes. But throughout, his journey is through a single being. There aren't two. There's only one. So the planes of our existence connotes more than simply the cosmic picture, because this is also our existence. This speaks to us personally as well. So as Sri Aurobindo was putting this essay forward in the Arya, obviously, this issue opened with the life divine, as it always did. And then he continues with essays on the Gita. And then only comes this chapter in the synthesis. In the life divine, he began to speak about the eternal and the individual. And then he went to works and sacrifice in essays on the Gita, and now he comes to the planes of our existence. And you can see the commonality of how this all comes into one capacious vision that he's sharing. And he has to write serially. He has to write month after month, taking us back to where he just departed, sharing with us what those leading insights were, and then carrying us forward from there. And then summarizing at the end where we've been, opening a door to where we'll be going. And so he had to do. He was running a journal, not writing a tight, sententious set of philosophical ideas, but having to unroll them month after month. So let's begin. Chapter 19, The Planes of Our Existence. If the Purusha in us has thus to become by union with its highest self, the divine Purusha, the knower, Lord, free enjoyer of its prakriti. It cannot be done evidently by dwelling on the present plane of our being, for that is the material plane in which the reign of prakriti is complete. There, the divine Purusha is entirely hidden in the blinding surge of her activities, in the gross pomp of her workings. And the individual soul, emerging from her involution of spirit in matter, subject in all its activities to its entangling in the material and vital instruments, is unable to experience the divine freedom. So, the first sentence tells us much. The Purusha in us, the real conscious person, the true being in us, can come into union, yukta, can yoke itself to the divine person because they are the same. But we can't get to that simply from our material encasement. We have to begin to get ourselves free so that we're not enmeshed in the play of nature. Now, he will redeem nature, prakriti, in a minute. What it calls its freedom and mastery is only the subtle subjection of mind to prakriti, which is lighter indeed, nearer to the possibility of liberty and rule than the gross subjection of vital and material things like the animal, plant, and metal, but is still not real freedom and mastery. Therefore, we have had to speak of different planes of our consciousness and of the spiritual planes of the mental being. For if these did not exist, the liberation of the embodied being would have been impossible here on earth. He would have had to wait, and at most to prepare himself for seeking it in other worlds and in a different kind of physical or spiritual embodiment, less obstinately sealed in its shell of material experience. So this is a call to freedom in the here and now, right here in the body, what a later tradition would call jivanmukta, to live free even while alive, and not to have to wait for a liberation that is outside the realm of our material existence. That is an idea that is common in spiritual philosophy. That is available in schools of Islam, that is available in the ancient and earliest teaching of Christianity. Irenaeus, the Irenaean theology, had it that the departing soul can improve its position by rising to a higher level inside the worlds, so to speak, do good service there, rise to a still higher level, and on until one begins to approach the kingdom of God. But that's not the question for Sri Aurobindo. It isn't, can we rise in consciousness and get to an extra cosmic solution to our suffering? But can we bring the experience of that freedom right here? Must we travel somewhere else to gain this? So he suggests here these subtler koshas, these sheaths, these inner bodies, but he doesn't describe them yet. In the ordinary yoga of knowledge, it is only necessary to recognize two planes of our consciousness, the spiritual and the materialized mental. The pure reason standing between these two views them both, cuts through the illusions of the phenomenal world, exceeds the materialized mental plane, sees the reality of the spiritual, and then the will of the individual Purusha, unifying itself with this poise of knowledge, rejects the lower and draws back to the supreme plane, dwells there, loses mind and body, sheds life from it, and merges itself in the supreme Purusha, is delivered from individual existence. So you can see here climbing the scales of Prakriti as described in the Sankhya philosophy to gain freedom. So the mental being, looking back to the body and looking above to that, can through a rejection of nature and accession only to that insight of what is truth, using the power of buddhi, the intelligent will to achieve it, can gain that contact with spirit, can become that consciousness, and lose connection, lose attachment, lose interest in this body, this life, this mind. It knows that this is not the whole truth of our existence, which is much more complex. It knows there are many planes, but it disregards them or pays little attention to them because they are not essential to this liberation. They indeed rather hamper it, because to live on them brings new attractive psychical experiences, psychical enjoyments, psychical powers, a new world of phenomenal knowledge, the pursuit of which creates stumbling blocks in the way of its one object, emergence in Brahman, and brings a succession of innumerable wayside snares on the road which leads to God. So these superphysical planes, if one gains access to them and develops the inner experience, have their own allurements, their own powers, their own enticements, their own subtle and rich enjoyments to be had, which stop you and become traps. These are way stations. And this knower will have nothing to do with this. This jnanin will have nothing to do with it. But since we accept world existence, and for us all world existence is Brahman and full of the presence of God, these things can have no terrors for us. Whatever dangers of distraction there may be, we have to face and overcome them. If the world and our own existence are so complex, we must know and embrace their complexities, in order that our self-knowledge and our knowledge of the dealings of Purusha with its Prakriti may be complete. If there are many planes, we have to possess them all for the divine, even as we seek to possess spiritually and transform our ordinary poise of mind, life, and body. And this, too, is something the Gita calls us to achieve. To understand not only the essence of being, but all the ways, all the tattvas that emerge from that into various distribution and manifestation. The ancient knowledge in all countries was full of the search after the hidden truths of our being, and it created that large field of practice and inquiry which goes in Europe by the name of occultism. We do not use any corresponding word in the East because these things do not seem to us so remote, mysterious, and abnormal as to the Occidental mentality. They are nearer to us, and the veil between our normal material life and this larger life is much thinner. So we can dwell on that for a moment. The ancient knowledge goes very far back. We have spoken of the Vedic and the Upanishadic knowledge, but even in the Brihadaranyaka, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, in the Katha a little bit later, finally in the Pingala Upanishad, we have direct expressions of what are these worlds, what are these steps of being. When we go to the West, well, sort of like the East coming into the West, we see Plotinus, or Plotinus if you prefer, putting forward his idea of the one who becomes all the way down to matter. We see in the Kabbalah something of this philosophy. We see in the Secret Doctrine by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky a direct description of the seven planes of being, which then Sri Aurobindo takes up and describes, of course, in his Life Divine, the sevenfold cord of being. Of course, with Sri Aurobindo, we have a much richer, more lucid and comprehensive picture of what is this cosmology than we get from Blavatsky. But give her credit. She was a pioneer, and had she not tried to bring spirituality into the West, we might still be waiting. So you can afford a bit of gratitude. So the Hermetic, the Rosicrucian, the Kabbalistic, you know, playing in the Western Renaissance, coming forward towards these times, which we inhabit. In India, for example, the Tantric in India, Egypt, Chaldea, China, Greece, the Celtic countries, they have formed part of various yogic systems and disciplines which had once a great hold everywhere, but to the modern mind have seemed mere superstition and mysticism, although the facts and experiences on which they are founded are quite as real in their own field and as much governed by intelligible laws of their own as the facts and experiences of the material world. It is not our intention here to plunge into this vast and difficult field of psychical knowledge. Another footnote. We hope to deal with it hereafter, but our first concern in the Arya must be with spiritual and philosophical truths. It is only when these have been grasped that the approach to the psychical becomes safe and clear. He's using the term psychical here, not to refer to the psychic being, the world of the soul itself, but of those worlds which form the inner terrain of the universe which we can come to know. And let's note again that the Arya was intended to be a philosophic, a sort of a high vision of things, not dealing with the pragmatic machinery of lifting one's consciousness into oneness with the divine. You can see even here in the synthesis of yoga, he's writing generally. He's not saying, now sit, now breathe, now withdraw your concentration. He's not trying to give you a how-to primer. He's talking about the large lines of yoga. But it becomes necessary now to deal with certain broad facts and principles which form its framework, for without them, our yoga of knowledge cannot be complete. We find that in the various systems, the facts dealt with are always the same, but there are considerable differences of theoretic and practical arrangement, as is natural and inevitable in dealing with a subject so large and difficult. Certain things are here omitted, there made all important, here understressed, there overemphasized. Certain fields of experience, which are in one system held to be merely subordinate provinces, are in others treated as separate kingdoms. But I shall follow here consistently the Vedic and Vedantic arrangement of which we find the great lines in the Upanishads. First, because it seems to me at once the simplest and most philosophical, and more especially because it was from the beginning envisaged from the point of view of the utility of these various planes to the supreme object of our liberation. So here he's talking about, again, the Brihadaranyaka, the Taittiriya, the Katha, the Pengala, all of those and more. So these planes that he's referring to are steps on the way to our liberation. They're not, to Sri Aurobindo's viewpoint, simply that they are layers intended for our self-possession as well. But the Upanishads don't lay great stress on that and are trying to point our attention to the realization of Brahman, of Atman. It takes as its basis the three principles of our ordinary being, mind, life, and matter, the triune spiritual principle of Satchit Ananda, and the link principle of Vijnana, supermind, the free or spiritual intelligence, and thus arranges all the large possible poises of our being in a tier of seven planes, sometimes regarded as five only, because only the lower five are wholly accessible to us, through which the developing being can rise to its perfection. So, I know if you were with us when we studied the Life Divine, this will be a commonplace, but let's go through it again. The five are mentioned directly in the Taittiriya Upanishad, the base being matter, anam. The power of life, the second, prana. The power of mind, the third, manas. The great consciousness, the great knowledge, vijnana, being the fourth. All of this pouring itself out from its essential oneness through ananda, the delightful expression of being. That's the fifth. That is the Taittiriya Upanishad. There is no Upanishad. There is no direct mention of these seven worlds in the manner that he describes here. Satchit Ananda is not itself a concept that arises in the Upanishads, but is developed a good bit later. So Sri Aurobindo is relying on his own developing experience, his own knowledge to express what is a fundamental truth in Veda and Vedanta, that there is this series of worlds leading from that down here and leading from this back. And we get something of that even in the materialistic view of the Sankhya as it describes the various regions of Prakriti coming into being from the Mahat, through Buddhi, through Ahankara, through Manas, through the various powers leading down to the gross senses and objects of the world. An inverse picture, because we think everything springs from matter, but even to the materialistic system of Prakriti, all comes from above. And so if we are delivered here into the material world, we need not simply rest with this fractional depiction of what is nature. We can use the powers of nature as we find them to climb back to that. And this indeed is a hidden secret of Prakriti, that her work continually pushes in its development the beings of the cosmos forward and upwards. Back to the text. But first, We must understand what we mean by planes of consciousness, planes of existence. We mean a general settled poise or world of relations between Purusha and Prakriti, between the soul and nature, writ large or writ small, whether it's the Supreme Person, Purushottama, and nature, Paraprakriti, or our soul and the nature we deal with. For anything that we can call world is and can be nothing else than the working out of a general relation which a universal existence has created or established between itself, or let us say, its eternal fact or potentiality and the powers of its becoming. So again, an existence, a sat, and a power of becoming, a chit tapas, a chit shakti. That existence and its relations with and its experience of the becoming is what we call soul or purusha. Ah, so soul represents sat. Individual soul in the individual, universal soul in the cosmos. The principle and the powers of the becoming are what we call nature or prakriti. But since being, conscious force, and delight of being are always the three constituent terms of existence, the nature of a world is really determined by the way in which prakriti is set to deal with these three primary things and the forms which it is allowed to give to them. For existence itself is and must always be the stuff of its own becoming. It must be shaped into the substance with which force has to deal. So the various planes represent different relations between Purusha and Prakriti according to the will of the Purusha, who is secretly the Prakriti. Force, again, must be the power which works out that substance and works with it to whatever ends. Force is that which we ordinarily call nature. So if sat is sheer existence, force is nature. Nature is chit shakti, expressing the intrinsic truth of the being of sat. Again, the end, the object with which the worlds are created, must be worked out by the consciousness inherent in all existence and all force and all their workings, and the object must be the possession of itself and of its delight of existence in the world. So all the world is an expression, a discussion between being and its own conscious power of what is possible and how can we work this universe and all the beings in it, which are myself and yourself, replicated and multiplied until we arrive at a concert of delight. Delight is the aim of the universe. Suffering is a happenstance, seemingly a sustained note on the way, but the note fades and delight assumes control. To that, all the circumstances and aims of any world existence must reduce themselves. It is existence developing its terms of being, its power of being, its conscious delight of being. If these are involved, their evolution. If they are veiled, their self-revelation. This is what development leads to. The disclosure of the great secret. Here, the soul lives in a material universe. Of that alone, it is immediately conscious. The realization of its potentialities in that is the problem with which it is concerned. But matter means the involution of the conscious delight of existence in self-oblivious force. And in a self-dividing, infinitesimally disaggregated form of substance. So the oneness of true being, the unity of consciousness in which all things adhere, in here, thrown out into this expression, this involution, divides, dulls, diminishes. Therefore, the whole principle and effort of a material world must be the evolution of what is involved and the development of what is undeveloped. Here, everything is shut up from the first in the violently working, inconscient sleep of material force. Therefore, the whole aim of any material becoming must be the waking of consciousness out of the inconscient. The whole consummation of a material becoming must be the removal of the veil of matter and the luminous revelation of the entirely self-conscient being to its own imprisoned soul in the becoming. Since man is such an imprisoned soul, this luminous liberation and coming to self-knowledge must be his highest object and the condition of his perfection. But the limitations of a material universe seem to be hostile to the proper accomplishment of this object, which is yet so inevitably the highest aim of a mental being born into a physical body. First, existence has formed itself here, fundamentally as matter. It has been objectivized, made sensible and concrete to its own self-experiencing conscious force in the form of self-dividing material substance. And by the aggregation of this matter, there has been built up for man a physical body separate, divided from others, and subject to the fixed habits of process, or as we call them, the laws of inconscient material nature. Note here, too, that secret that sat is the truth of matter at its basis. His force of being, too, is nature or force working in matter, which has waked slowly out of inconscience to life and is always limited by form, always dependent on the body, always separated by it from the rest of life and from other living beings, always hampered in its development, persistence, self-perfectioning by the laws of the inconscience and the limitations of bodily living. So because of this disaggregation, life doesn't get its ending either. Living in the body cramps it. Equally, his consciousness is a mentality emerging in a body and in a sharply individualized life. It is, therefore, limited in its workings and capacities and dependent on bodily organs of no great competence and on a very restricted vital force. It is separated from the rest of cosmic mind and shut out from the thoughts of other mental beings whose inner workings are a sealed book to man's physical mind, except insofar as he can read them by the analogy of his own mentality and by their insufficient bodily signs and self-expressions. So just as we can't physically feel at one with other beings because they seem to be separate and discontinuous, And just as our life guesses, lunges for, yearns for the embrace of other life powers encased in bodies, so too the intrapsychic doors of the mind are closed, and we can't really know the inner thoughts of others. We yearn for this oneness. We yearn to be yukta, yoked again to these deeper truths that stem from the soul and arise from the Atman and come cascading down into the universe from that mighty oneness above. But here we are, and we have to evolve out of it. His consciousness is always falling back towards the inconscience, in which a large part of it is always involved, his life towards death, his physical being towards disaggregation. So this is the gravity of inconscience pulling us down. Even when we climb a bit, a bad ending comes, and we go tumbling back towards the abyss. His delight of being depends on the relations of this imperfect consciousness with its environment, based upon physical sensations and the sense mind. In other words, on a limited mind trying to lay hold on a world external and foreign to it by means of a limited body, limited vital force, limited organs. Therefore, its power for possession is limited. Its force for delight is limited. And every touch of the world which exceeds its force, which that force cannot bear, cannot seize on, cannot assimilate and possess, must turn to something else than delight, to pain, discomfort, or grief. So it's our limitation, it's our fragmentation, our separation from that which we really are, which is the cause of our littleness, of our mortality, of our undelight. Or else it must be met by non-reception, insensibility, or if received, put away by indifference. Moreover, such delight of being as it possesses is not possessed naturally and eternally, like the self-delight of Satchit Ananda, but by experience and acquisition in time. And can therefore only be maintained and prolonged by repetition of experience, and is in its nature precarious and transient. So we have to multiply. We experience, we get a glimpse, we fall back, we come back, we experience again, we get a little bit more penetration. But we're having to do it successively in time because we've forgotten the one moment in which we always truly live, eternity. For now, we'll put a bookmark there. And we'll come back to speak about the eternal verities next Sunday at 7 in Pensacola time. So, if you have a little patience more, we'll read from Savitri. Let's continue. We were reading about the he and the she of things. So why don't we come back and read in continuation of that. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, and we're going to start on page 65. Although she drives him on her fancy's roads, at play with him as with her child or slave, to freedom and the eternal's mastery, and immortality's stand above the world, she moves her seeming puppet of an hour. Even in his mortal session in body's house, an aimless traveler between birth and death, ephemeral, dreaming of immortality. To reign, she spurs him. He takes up her powers. He has harnessed her to the yoke of her own law. His face of human thought puts on a crown, held in her leash, bound to her veiled caprice. He studies her ways, if so he may prevail even for an hour, and she work out his will. He makes of her his moment passion's serf. To obey she feigns, she follows her creature's lead. For him she was made, lives only for his use. But conquering her, then is he most her slave. He is her dependent, all his means are hers. Nothing without her he can. She rules him still. At last he wakes to a memory of self. He sees within the face of deity. The Godhead breaks out through the human mold. Her highest heights she unmasks and is his mate. Till then he is a plaything in her game. Her seeming regent, yet her fancy's toy, a living robot moved by her energy's springs. He acts as in the movements of a dream, an automaton stepping in the grooves of fate. He stumbles on, driven by her whip of force. His thought labors, a bullock in time's fields. His will, he thinks his own, is shaped in her forge. Obedient to world nature's dumb control, driven by his own formidable power, his chosen partner in a titan game, her will he has made the master of his fate, her whim the dispenser of his pleasure and pain. He has sold himself into her regal power for any blow or boon that she may choose. Even in what is suffering to our sense, he feels the sweetness of her mastering touch. In all experience meets her blissful hands. On his heart he bears the happiness of her tread and the surprise of her arrival's joy in each event and every moment's chance. All she can do is marvelous in his sight. He revels in her, a swimmer in her sea, a tireless amateur of her world delight. He rejoices in her every thought and act, and gives consent to all that she can wish. Whatever she desires, he wills to be. The Spirit, the innumerable one, he has left behind his lone eternity. He is an endless birth and endless time, her finite's multitude in an infinite space. Namaste, Jai Ma.